We're in Dr. Bill Clapp's office. We're going to interview him on the history of technology at Weber State. This is Nicholas Barone. Start up. And we can start. Well, I'm Nicholas Barone. Nice to meet you, sir.
Great you're here. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick recap on life. Where and when were you born?
I was born in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, 1949, but my parents moved to San Diego in the early 50s, and so I grew up in San Diego. Should I keep going? Give you a little bit of background. I grew up in San Diego, attended San Diego State University for a bachelor's degree, San Diego State University for a master's degree, moved to Utah in the late 70s, and started to work at Utah Valley State College. Back then it was called Utah Technical College, Provo. And then moved up to Salt Lake City Community College for a few years, and then joined Weber State University in 1984. And after that, joining Weber State University, then finished an educational doctorate at Brigham Young University in 89.
Okay. How did you get involved in the military throughout this?
The military, I was always a patriotic person, grew up in San Diego, which is a Navy town, decided not to go Navy, went Air Force when I was just a youngster, and joined the active duty Air Force back in 1971 out of ROTC, the height of the Vietnam War. Wanted to serve, went in as an aircraft maintenance officer for a number of years, got out in 74, came back in the military in 82, a number of years after I had my master's degree, came back in as a officer and was the chief of maintenance of a mobile radar unit in the Utah Air National Guard for 14 years, and then got assigned to Air Force Research Labs as a scientist. And last year I was militarily activated and spent a year in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, and retired last May of 2004 with 31 and a half years reserve.
Very nice. What did, as a maintainer, what type of stuff did you do?
As a maintainer, aircraft maintenance officer at Fairchild Air Force Base, when I was just a young lieutenant, B-52s, KC-135s, climbed all over them, supervised about 50 technicians in the avionics portion, all the electronic gear aboard those 45 different airplanes that we had. And then when I came back in as a chief of maintenance of a mobile radar unit, went all over the world with a powerful tactical radar. We were always 50 miles from the front lines, controlling aircraft, getting them into their targets, getting them to refuel, and if they interdict any enemy aircraft, we would supervise the pilots, give them a heads up where the enemy was in dogfights, and then transfer to Air Force Research Labs, Space Vehicle Directorate, helping them design spacecraft, and then the last 5 years, Human Effectiveness Directorate, dealing with altitude chambers, rocket sleds, and help them improve human performance as a warfighter.
Do you feel that your military background helped in your university, or do you feel that your university education helped in your military?
No, absolutely. The two were very complementary, because in a computer, electronics, engineering, technology department, which we have 300 students, and being one of their instructors, it really did help to be able to explain the communication systems we use to understand when you have a mobile radar unit, which is a very, very powerful radar system. Plus, you have microwave satellite systems, HF radios, UHF radios, and all the equipment and trucks and telephone intercom systems, tremendous communication systems. That knowledge I've been able to share with students. And then especially with Air Force Research Labs, the latest in spacecraft satellites and human performance, which is night vision goggles or extra hearing protection, body protection, which is electronic related, has really been very, very complementary, and I think it's helped the university.
How have you seen, in the military sense, the technology advancing? I mean, because you've been in it for a very long time, what type of technological advances did you see that just totally were mind-boggling?
Well, for example, this last year when I was activated, I was a general's assistant, and the general had 1,200 scientists and engineers working for him, and I was his assistant. I got to see all the latest technologies that were being developed. for example, night vision goggles. We've had them for years, but now we're just developing a new one. It's 100 degree wide in its view, not a narrow 30 degrees. So now the pilots will have peripheral vision, so they can fly more effectively and safely at night. And then the hearing protection, of which we developed, flew on the latest Spaceship One, which is a commercial spaceship that went up from the Mojave Desert last summer. And the hearing devices that they used that we developed allowed them to communicate during the rocket propulsion, very noisy environment. And it's helped the F-22 to fly again because of the noisy environments. And then we also have the centrifuges, which we're trying to figure out why people are fainting to keep them, the pilots, so they can endure rougher flights, more G-forces, and the stress and strains. So the electronics developments have been just tremendous. We're working on a device now that can put people on the ground without hurting them, because we have figured out the exact frequency that hits the nerve endings for all your pain sensors. And it just resonates the pain sensors, but it doesn't inflict any damage to your body. And we're always looking for ways of non-lethal way of crowd control, because no one in the military wants to kill anybody. And we'd rather put them on the ground and incapacitate them if possible. And this is one of the breakthroughs that are related to radio frequencies, and because we have figured out exactly that frequency. So we're looking for volunteers if you want to run across the field and see if we can take you down.
I'd actually enjoy doing that,
just to
have a test run or mock run and stuff like that. That'd be fun. When you first attended the university, what type of electronics, while you were learning, what type of stuff did you learn on?
I was brought in because of my printed circuit board design capability and project development, taking projects through, and so I was really into the design of these circuits and the implementation of these circuits in a usable manner, more of the applied manner, which we specialized in. We do really well here at Weber State, is we have engineering technology programs, not electrical engineering, but engineering technology, which means it's very applied, hands-on. And we have the difference between a EE and an EET, for example, is we require students to take 50% more electronics courses and less math and less theory, but get right down to the brass tacks and get them involved in the circuits themselves.
Mm. Now, when you're working with circuits, are you using anything like in specific? Are you talking about circuits like on motherboards or stuff like that, or are you talking about like circuits on trying to understand where?
We start out with the very basics of circuits and what a transistor is, because every computer has millions and millions of transistors in it as the basic building block for computers. And you take a couple of transistors and that turns into a gate, and a gate is a flip-flop device which can store ones and zeros. And if you have millions, like a memory chip, every single memory bit takes four transistor devices to create a memory bit. So if you have 6 gigabytes of memory, I can tell you, you've got about 24 billion transistors inside one memory device. I mean, just a tremendous number. So the technology is very, very, very important. We'll just let the phone ring.
Okay. How do you, because transistors are so tiny and stuff like that, if you have 24 million transistors working, how do you implement those into such small amounts of area?
That's where our semiconductor manufacturing industry takes over. Is they're creating devices now that are programmable. So if you have a special circuit, a lot of them now are what we call field programmable gate arrays, kind of a sophisticated FPGA concept. But this basic circuit elements are on a chip that you program with a computer to function and have certain characteristics when you get through programming the chip, and then it's programmed forever, or you can reprogram it. So it's all, the whole system is now in a chip.
Oh, wow. When you first became employed here, what stuff did you start with? Like, what was the environment when you first got here, and maybe a progression through time to where it is now?
When I first started, we were talking about vacuum tubes. I mean, some of the old technology that we've been dealing with, it just, every year it turns over new technology. We very seldom teach a class the same way twice in a row because of the new technologies, which is just, it's always changing. So we always are perceived as being unprepared in teaching our classes, because when we stand up, we have not taught it that way before, because the courses continually change, which is unlike a traditional course where you can teach the same way for five or 6 years, get really good at it, and you know exactly what you're doing. Well, we come in and we kind of have to fly through these things using the latest technologies that are being presented.
Okay. Can we hold for just 1 second?
Returning.
So when, more along the history lines of when you were here, maybe start even just going through your bachelor's or your undergraduate, stuff must have been a lot different then than it is now.
I got my bachelor's degree in 1971, where computers were really non-existent. My first computer class was an analog computer class, and there was no such thing as computer chips. And so my history goes way back to that. But when I came here in 84, computers were common, but they were huge. And when I got here in 84, we had a TV repair shop down the hall, and it was just full of televisions, and there was the vacuum tubes all over the place. And if you walk down our hall now, it's new, it's modern. We're ripping apart our labs all the time. We always have a lab in transition, and this year we cleaned out one of our older labs and put in a senior projects lab. So every year is just update, update, update. And it drives us crazy, but that's the nature of technology and engineering. The older professors have moved on. The group we have now, the six full-time tenured faculty members we have been here all for over 20 years. So we are all the group that was hired from 84 to 85, because there was a big turnover of the faculty leaving. They had three retire 1 year, and a couple more retire the next year. So we're the leftover group, and we're hiring for the first time a replacement and a new person. We haven't hired a new person in some time. We're just into that mode again as we realize we're reaching the end of our careers, that we need to replace ourselves with a lot younger people that will carry on with the energy that we had. That as we get older, that energy is kind of dropping off a bit, but that's life.
You were talking about a lot of analog, like televisions and stuff like that. The progression from analog to digital, how is that as an engineer? What did that entitle you guys to, and how did you guys do that progression from taking things from analog? Because I know I used to take pick film. When I used to shoot on film.
Have to use film.
And now I don't use film anymore.
Now it's all digital.
It's all digital. So how is your progression into the digital age, and what was that like?
What we've done is we kind of have a pipeline theory that all these new technologies are brought in as upper division courses. And then as they become common, we compress them and put them into lower division courses. So we have this big funnel. All our new technologies are third, fourth year courses, because the students are juniors or seniors. They're willing to do a lot of the research and the work themselves. It's less supervised, it's less structured. So we bring in all these new topics, and then when it eventually turns into textbooks and becomes more common, we compress them and move them on down to where it's easier for our faculty to teach it at the lower. So every one of our faculty, to make this work, teaches a special niche in an upper division, and then they have to teach two-thirds of their workload in the lower division. So they're reaching out way ahead, and then they're also having to support the students that are coming in at the lower division, which is like a 3-to-1 ratio. We have a lot of students in lower division by the time we have the normal reductions that occur. Then they're really prepared to handle the newer technologies.
Do you guys do your own research and design, R&D, in per se, when it comes to staying on top of things, technology? Because you were saying you're ever changing, does that have some sort of mandate that comes down to you as a university, or do you guys make the effort?
That's a great question, because each of us is expected to stay current in the scholarship area, stay current in the areas in which we are specializing in. And each of us, all but one, are working on the outside as consultants. My Air Force consulting with Air Force Research Labs is one vehicle for me to keep me current. Plus, I'm also the station chief engineer for KWCR, the campus radio. So we have students that are staying ahead of the technology, and we're trying to push the students in radio station technology, because we're going to be upgrading all the equipment in the next couple of years to the latest technology. every one of our faculty, they are doing things in the consulting world, and we allow that to happen. We allow, out of the 40-hour contract during the week, we allow by our policies and procedures within our department that we expect them to take one of those days, 8 hours of a 40-hour work week while they're here on campus, that they can do their consulting work out of their office to stay current. So we really encourage it. And one professor we're losing this year, we tried to hire a new professor. He was a heart pump inventor, PhD from the University of Utah. His company was falling apart. It wasn't funded. He came, took a teaching job. Now all of a sudden there's new life in the company. There's a merger, $10 million. They made a big offer to come back, and he was tempted to come back. So you play a game that if you stay close to technology, you're always going to be tempted to go back into industry. So we want to learn as much as we can of the new technology without being lured back, and that's why we go on sabbaticals. We have our faculty go on sabbaticals because they just get carried away, go back into industry, realize that they miss teaching, and then hopefully they'll come back.
Oh, very nice. When you're saying that you have your lower divisionals and your upper divisionals, and the upper divisionals are more of the newer technology, what are some of the things that the lower divisional students are taking on that might be more of a...
The strength of our course, our whole program, the bachelor's and associate degree programs in computer engineering technology and electronics engineering technology, is we're really based on the fundamentals for the first 2 years. We require two physics classes, physics for engineers, we require a lot of math, and we get them into electronics principles. Very, very elementary principles that have been around for 100 years. I mean, they've been around for some time, so there's well-written textbooks. We ground them in the fundamentals. So the first year is a pretty standard. It doesn't change nearly as fast because that's the bottom of the compression. So as you're forcing things, the new technologies, they merge. It's like finding dinosaur bones. You know, when you, by the time you get them, they're there and they're solid and you can use them. That's only good for the first year because we need to start getting the latest technologies. We have to get them through the fundamentals. You have to understand how a transistor works if you're going to really understand how a computer works. Mm-hmm. So we'll go back to the fundamentals, which I think is our strength, because in many ways we really don't care. It's not that important. If technology takes a dramatic change, our students have the fundamentals. Let me give you an example. Wireless is the latest craze in computer technology. Everyone's wireless, go wireless. Well, we've been teaching wireless technology in this department for 40 years. This is just another application of radio frequency communications. And so this is why our students can hop from one technology to another if they're good at the fundamentals.
So the fundamentals become a key. You brought up working for the radio station. How long have you worked for them, and what was it like when you first started, and how has it changed?
I've been the chief engineer for this radio station since I started here about 1986, so 2 years after I had come here. The station was running on 100 watts on a transmitter that wasn't working. It was in the communications building. I can remember the first couple weeks I was there, they had an important basketball game, and the transmitter was cutting in and out because it had been overheated and busted so many times that during that whole basketball game, I was sitting on the transmitter pushing the circuit card down with a pencil because the card was cracked and broken so many places that I found a way to keep the transmitter online if I stood there. So during the whole game, I'm trying to hold this pencil down and try to figure out how to prop it up and find something else to push down the circuit board to keep it working. And I was glad that game was over because then the music wasn't nearly as important. And then we went about upgrading the equipment. So now we have some really good equipment, but that equipment is 10 years old and it's time to replace it again. We're talking about the very first transmitter is a 10-watt transmitter, and the station license goes back to the mid-70s, and I have the original license application for that radio station. 10 watts, and then it went to 100 watts, and we took it to 2,000 watts in 1991, so they've been at the higher wattage for some time. But now we're talking about moving the transmitter from the top of Promontory Tower to maybe the top of Minnehaha in the next go-around.
Do you guys deal with satellites or anything like that, or satellite technology?
Back in 85, a year after I had started, it was the satellite technology that brought me to Weber State. I was so interested in it. In 84, when I started, they were constructing a satellite. And it was the size of a basketball. It was just full of wires. And it was just fascinating for me. And so the first year that I was here, I helped out on the printed circuit board designs and the packaging for that satellite. And a year later, that went into space on the shuttle Challenger. Now, that was the Challenger flight before the disaster the year later. Disaster in 86. So we launched our satellite in 85 and put our first satellite in space. And from that, we started the Center for Aerospace Technology. We have built a half a dozen spacecraft. Five of them are still in space. They've reached their life expectancy because when you build a satellite, it lasts for a few years, then you wait for it to deorbit. So we still have a couple of those up there. We're not doing satellites right now. We did that very effectively for 15 years. We graduated a lot of students that were interested in aerospace, placed them. But the satellite technology matured. What happened is we commercialized it. It went off campus. And then we had 9/11 that killed the space industry. And now we're not doing satellites anymore. So for 15 years.
Was it enjoyable? Well, how is that different than doing like radios or TVs or computers?
Well, I was doing that as my volunteer 8 hours a week. I was volunteered as the associate director for 12 years. I just went to meetings, went all over the world because of the funding that came. I mean, we had a conference in France. We went to Australia. We interfaced these spacecraft. One of our members went down to French Guiana when we launched one of ours, and so he was there for the launch. And I just talked to a friend yesterday that's now 65 years old, and he went to Kennedy Space Center and took our satellite with him to put it aboard the shuttle back in 1985. What was neat about that is satellites are so small and dense and complete operating systems that really becomes an ideal package for a complete system, like an automobile. Right. It's a complete system. And what's neat about spacecraft, when you get done with it, you don't have to store it anywhere. You just put it in space and it's gone. And luckily, if we're lucky, it works for a few years. The mission is accomplished and you go about building the other. We use students extensively. Students did a lot of the work and they helped them get placed.
How would you maintain something like that? Would it have to come down if it was maintained, or was the technology there that you could fix something from down here that's up in orbit?
Now, once it goes in space, you can't touch it, and that's the real challenge. It's forever unreachable. So once you launch it, if you've made mistakes, it's a goner. The very first satellite we launched, when it went into space, there was a temperature change on it, and it took us 3 months to contact it. Because the temperature of space was different enough that the frequencies changed with the satellite, and we were just scratching our heads at what do we try next? And went through a checklist of 100 different items before we figured out what had happened in space, and then we had instant contact with it. We were just cheering. We thought we had lost it forever. So that becomes a real realistic diagnostic system. The sad part is you can't just grab it and bring it to your shop and fix it. That's the real downside. So we did have one satellite that quit functioning after a while, and we couldn't make communication contact. No matter what we did, it was lost. But the others, a lot of them, we communicated with it thousands of times, got pictures from space, and we did our experiments.
How does Bluetooth apply to you guys? Do you guys deal with any, because you were talking about wireless, do you guys do anything with that?
Now, Bluetooth is the commercial frequencies used by computer users now to communicate locally. They don't work for long distance hauls. You have to use the traditional high power bands. Because the Bluetooth is like the CB radio of the 70s where you get 40 channels and you can communicate short distances. Bluetooth allows everybody to get involved with low power so you don't interfere with your friends. The FCC doesn't get too involved or too concerned because you're not interfering with somebody across town because it doesn't transmit that far. So Bluetooth is everywhere, and our circuits include the training for that because we teach those principles. This is another application of a particular band that the FCC has authorized that you have to transmit within this band. You can transmit a certain bandwidth so computers can communicate between their peripheral devices. So we are there, and our companies are hiring our students because of their experiences with RF design for the future products.
Back, I know that just because of my little bit of my education in this sort of area in telecommunications, cable, you know, we had cable, we got fiber optics, we have, you know, wireless, different ways of transmitting information from one point to another. When cable first came out, what were, and if you were involved in any type of wiring of cables and stuff like that, the bandwidth that could run through a cable is different from fiber optics. Can you kind of go over that?
Yeah, the higher frequency you go, the greater the bandwidth. And so that's why, for example, lasers are so important today, because light is very, very high frequency. That means you can modulate a light beam with a really wide bandwidth, and that's why fiber optics is really, really important today. A radio frequency, like AM radio and FM radio, is very limited in bandwidth because it's fairly low frequency. AM radio, you're allowed a bandwidth of 10 kilohertz on each side, and the audio doesn't sound real good, so you go to higher frequency FM. Now you're talking about 100 kilohertz bandwidth, which means you can put a higher fidelity sound in it. Then you get up into television, which is even better because the video signals take quite a bandwidth. Now we're getting into digital transmissions. For example, L3 Communications has very wideband, high-power radio frequency equipment because they're transmitting huge pictures, photographs, images that require tremendous bandwidth. So we keep going to higher frequencies, wider bandwidth, and we can remember the day that Morse code, dits and dots. I can tell you, I still remember the Morse code. I can't get it out of my head. You know, dit da da dit 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 da dit da dit ABC. I just gave you three letters. It's in my head. I need to get rid of that so we make room for some newer stuff. But those are the days that bandwidth, we just didn't know how to go high enough frequency. So yes, when cable TV allowed us to go a tremendous bandwidth, and then I went to fiber optics, and we have one of our faculty members here has an invention on scrambling satellite television. He is the inventor of scrambling of satellite TV. Wow. So when you turn to your satellite dishes, not so much now the direct TV, but the older satellite TV that used to be, where you used to have to use the big 8-foot dishes, the big 10-foot dishes.
Yeah.
He has the patent on that.
Wow.
And that's why you still can't de-scramble it, but people have figured out how to de-scramble that. To Bob's disappointment.
I have a question on, you send information through cables, you send them through wires, you send them through lines, but how is information traveling through the wireless? How can I wirelessly communicate with someone else when you think physically and you think AB, well, I can understand information going through a cable, but how is that information going wireless? Does it hit a satellite? Does it have to go somewhere before it returns?
Well, everything in this world deals with resonant frequency. Your voice, of which we were talking, is a resonant frequency at a very low audio tone. And you go higher, and then it's ultrasonic. And you go higher, then it becomes AM radio, FM radio. And everything is a resonant frequency. So to be able to transmit radio frequencies through the air, you have to create an antenna that is scientists of our past, the historians. They're the ones that figured out how to take a radio frequency and send it through the air with what's called an antenna. Antenna is a very finely tuned device that transmits the electrical energy transmits it into the air medium and allows it to be transmitted all over, like FM radios. It's everywhere. It bounces, and you have to have receivers. And we just uncovered a new technology, which is just wonderful. Ultrasonic. I can send an ultrasonic signal to you, two different ultrasonic signals, and your head will become the receiver. You don't even need a receiver. I can put voices in your head, and we're going to start a research project next year that I'm sponsoring in this department. So you won't know where the sounds are coming from. Your head will hear it, and you can't shut it off because it's not coming through headphones, it's not coming through audio, and you can't put a helmet on to stop it. So we're learning every day. We're learning new technologies. All the way up to laser frequency and higher. Learning how to modulate it to make it useful. We teach data communications. We just added a new course this semester called Digital Communications. We already have a communications course where we talk about the basics, but it changes so quickly. How do you input valuable information and send it somewhere, whether it be by wire or wireless or by light.
Right. Very interesting stuff. When you come here, or as a student, or as a teacher, instructor, you were saying that there's a lot of transistors, and transistors go in a lot of different things. Do you guys focus as you walk through the hallway? You can see different things. You see lower-end computers, then you see higher-end computers, and then you see, I think I saw radios maybe on one of those rooms over on the left side. Are you taking everything in at one time because they all somehow intertwine together? Or do computers do something different than a TV, and does a TV do something different than a radio? And the students go through each, you know, appliance or a piece of electronics?
Our students have to take 20 different classes. And so we have, the best we can, we have figured out a sequence of getting through, not killing our students to begin with, trying to make it understandable. And this is really Nerdsville. I mean, this is a place where students care about how physics works and how to make the world a better place on the application. So we have 10 different lab rooms. Some have basic test equipment, some have specialized equipment, and some have just computers. And some have computers that we tear apart. So we have created what we hope to be is, which seems to be a successful sequence of how to present that information without overwhelming or boring our students, which makes it very difficult.
Right.
You have to teach the fundamentals before you can get to the fun stuff.
We got to do that.
Well, and if you wait to do that, then you'll lose students because they say, this is boring, I want to get to the fun stuff. Well, it's a tough decision every day that we make.
Well, and I work in the same kind of environment where we're trying to do interactive, hands-on training, but have the people in front of the computers. People don't want to sit there and read a book. They want, especially, I know that because we have CET in the military, and they want to physically learn on the appliances and on the planes, and they don't want to sit there and read a TO.
Which stands for technical order, for right. Those listening. We're experimenting with a new course. We added a new course to our beginning courses. We used to teach AC/DC and digital circuits, and we're finding that that's too focused in one area. So we added a new course in front called Basic Electronics. It's a 2-credit course, and it covers everything. It covers just what you're talking about. You're in the lab building little light bulbs and little circuits, and we're not hung up on the technology or having to teach you everything. So it's a lot of fun. And it's so much fun, and the course is getting more popular that it's becoming a required course for some of the other departments. For your telecommunications department, it is now the 1110 Basic Electronics is a required course for your program because we want to give you an overview that is fun. So we're always making the trade-off, trying to make it fun, but then how can you get into it deep, into serious, into the engineering side? It's a tough line that we walk every day because every time we make a decision, we some students or we get some students excited.
How have the classrooms changed over the years? How has your teaching changed? Maybe not on the technology, but physically on the environments that you are finding yourself in have changed.
What we have found, it really doesn't make any difference. This is going to be a little bold. It doesn't make any difference what technology we teach. Whatever technology we teach will be outdated. Couple years, 2 years. So what we've learned over the years, it doesn't matter the technology. What matters is your problem-solving skills. So we'll set you up with the technology the best we can with the current technology. Then we will have you analyze it, troubleshoot it, improve it, and then 5 years from now, that technology, everyone will laugh at it. But that's not the point. The point we're trying to do is from that, you can be given any kind of problem, know how to analyze and problem solve and go after a solution. So as good as we try to be on the technology, we know it's going to be useless in a couple of years. Unless it gets compressed into the fundamentals, and then there's our only security or continuity is the lower division courses. If you're lucky enough to teach those, wow, that may look pretty much the same course next year or the year after, but not far beyond that.
Right. Do you enjoy teaching? Which we'll even ask that. Because you come from a military background, and we're a lot of hands-on. We, as we progress through our ranks, we do a lot of mentoring and teaching. that doesn't fit into everybody's groove. Did you enjoy more doing the hands-on work, or do you enjoy?
I started out as an electrical engineer, and it wasn't hands-on at all. It was all theoretical, and I fell back to the electronics technology program because I wanted to build things. I grew up in my dad's workshop. He was an engineer, a mechanical engineer, and I was building electronic circuits when I was a teenager. And I've had more things blow up in my dad's garage, and it'd come out. I remember one thing I blew up in the garage at 6:30 in the morning after I had my paper out. Smoke all over the place, circuit breaker blown, and my dad was just getting up. And I don't remember what he said, but I'm sure it wasn't very nice. trying to burn the house down, so he helped me build a little shop, and that's what prompted or encouraged me to continue with that kind of. But then I learned that I wanted to teach a long time ago, and all of us here, the remaining six faculty that we have that are reaching retirement, our joy comes from watching the light turn on in somebody else's eyeballs when they learn a new concept. We've all been in industry, and that's one of the requirements. You have to have 5 years industrial experience before we'll even consider you for a job here, plus a minimum master's degree. And what we're finding is we'd rather home grow our folks. And we don't necessarily want the PhD candidates that may not have the drive to want to teach. So we find teachers that people want to teach early, and then we help them go back and get their master's degrees, PhDs. I've left teaching 3 times. I got tempted. I used to teach at Utah Valley State College. I left there to go to industry. A year or two later, I was back into teaching, took another teaching job at Salt Lake City Community College. I left there because I get so caught up. I love the technology, but when I get into the technology, working 50, 60 hours a week, I miss the students. I miss the laboratory environments with students. And, of course, I miss having the summers free, too. So that's part of it. That's all part of the combination. But I think we're all here because this is where we want to be. But there's a critical line is to stay current in technology. So as much as we want to teach, I have left the 2 other teaching jobs because they wouldn't let me stay current in electronics. I was teaching. I needed to get a place where I could do some of the research and keep up with the technology. And that's what I did at the Center of Aerospace Technology. I was able to do that with the Air Force, and they encouraged me to do that. So that allowed me to find a safe haven of continual growth in new scholarship, new technology, and still teach enough to satisfy that part. It's a very delicate line of which I have fallen off that many, many times, and so have our other faculty.
I'm just interested in the way, because I just want to know, what was it like when you had a computer the size of the room, almost, and you were having to maintain something like that, and going through that progression of just watching it get smaller and smaller and smaller, and going, and you had to be a part of that in some way because, you know, you're working with these electronics and you have to see this, you know, as the time goes on. We have Palm Pilots now that are more powerful than the computers that I joined the military with in 1998. How was that progression for you? What was that like?
Engineers are strange people. They're analytical, and they always want to see improvements. If something isn't improved, you might as well quit and go somewhere else. We can't stand if something stands still. The first computer that I had when I came here in 1984 was a Commodore PET computer. My Commodore PET, I could walk across the room and touch the screen. It would lock up on me and freeze up every time. And all I had was a little word processor, and it didn't do anything. Okay, I could generate a document. But it was never good enough. And you look at computers today, I get so dissatisfied with them because they can't do what you hope they will do. And so you keep pushing the technology to the next technology. You keep pushing it, and if you can help educate these students and help empower them to be tomorrow's designers, tomorrow's people that want to make the changes, that's what makes this so much fun, is to be part of the change, staying on top of this.
Looking to the future, what place does engineering or the knowledge of engineering have in artificial intelligence and stuff like that?
You wouldn't have this if it wasn't for engineers and scientists. because they don't mind turning over their life. That's why we're nerds. If you take an engineer, he'll take a good portion of his life, more than any traditional person would ever do, and focus on a subject that no one else cares about. It's just incredible. Boy, you're really weird. I mean, all you care about is that little circuit. Well, that's what motivates us. But then we understand that nerds have a tough time getting hired, so we really round out the students. We require a senior project that requires a student to communicate, to make presentations, to work with others in teams. So I think that's what's different, a lot different about our program in electronics engineering technology and computer engineering technology. We care about the whole person and the transition. Some engineers can't communicate well. We think we turn out people that can communicate well and still be the interface between the customer and the real strange scientist who creates these things in a black hole. Then we come along as the technologist and move it from an idea in somebody's head to a bizarre little project sitting on a table to something that we can use and have fun with and market. And if we can market it, then we create positions and jobs for our graduates, because everything in this nation is based around manufacturing. And if we're continually manufacturing new products, then we're providing employment. And if we're providing employment, sales to the world, then we can have a higher standard of living than other countries.
Very nice. You talked about one future of what you guys are looking at. What other stuff are you looking at? Is there anything that you guys have on the edge of your seats, or you know that, that's interesting, but we know we're not going to be at that stage for like 2 or 3 years. We have to wait till we get to there.
We have to wait for some of these products to become reproducible. So we're always looking at the technologies and the leading manufacturing companies that kick out new chips for us, new sensors, new computers, and then we're quick to grab that new technology and package it different, put it in a new application, solve somebody's manufacturing problem. Because if the only way America is going to continue to be strong is if we can out-manufacture other nations. Third world countries, for example, they can make things really cheap, but if we can automate it in a smarter, quicker, high quality, less failure rate, then we can still outdo their labor. And so the only way to keep America strong is to throw all this technology into automation. And we're right behind it. That's where we are. We're really into robotics, automation, the latest microprocessors, the small chips, and their applications. For example, a new automobile has about 20 microprocessors in it. Everything is communicating throughout an automobile now with microprocessors. Even your windshield wipers and your radio, it's all interconnected, intertwined communication system. And we know that's very important.
They talk about being able to put like video cameras and stuff into tips of pencils and erasers and stuff like that. How did technology move to that stage? How are we able to get smaller and smaller? Because for me, you know, being ignorant to the process, I know the CPUs were big. They're getting smaller and smaller and able to have more information in them and go faster and faster. But how is that possible? How are you guys able to go smaller and smaller?
Everything is incremental. If you can put one transistor on a chip, you think about it long enough and work on it, then you can put two transistors. It's nothing that is magical. It's one step at a time. Somebody trying to improve it by 10%. Somebody putting, instead of 1 million, they figured out how to put 2 million. So, and it's just, it's a progressive growth. For example, one of my research students, he researched what's called the video pill. It's a pill that you swallow that has 6 cameras on board, and it follows all the way through your system, so you don't have to have the traditional test being done to where you can just wear a belly pack around your waist. It transmits wireless to the belly pack, and it accumulates like 50,000 pictures as it progresses through your system. And it's a far better, more accurate test or view of the inside of your system. And that's all because of technology. So we are getting into nanotechnology. It's all progressive. It's not a miracle at all. One step at a time.
So we could be mean, you could have an infinite number of transistors at some time into something.
Yeah, absolutely. There's more technology available in a small chip. The biggest problem is you can put a lot of memory, a lot of data into a small device, but the difficulty becomes how you get it in and out of the device, and how do you make it useful? For example, a computer has a keyboard. Boy, you're never going to make a keyboard very small because you're trying to interface with a human. The only other way now is to do by voice signals or direct connections to the brain. We've got to keep progressing in that area because a lot of data on a small chip doesn't help you if you can't use it or convert it to something else. But look at these big, huge monitor screens. Well, let's do internal. Let's do head-mounted. Let's do other kinds of sensory devices. And that's where the Air Force Research Labs really helped me out in the human performance. How do you give a little extra added 2% performance to a warfighter, so if he meets his equal in the sky, he can outmaneuver. It's all incremental. It's nothing significant breakthrough. One little thing at a time.
Is that why, and you might not know this, but I've been in a lot of planes, F-16s, F-15s, I take a lot of pictures of all these planes. You grab the hold of the joystick of these fighters, they don't move. They do this very infinite,
yeah,
small movement.
It's just the pressure, and the reason they have done that is when you're experiencing 8 G-forces, you can't move your hand very far. You can't even lift your foot off the ground. So you don't want to have to move your body parts very far to get the airplane to respond. So all you have to do on that is pull your arm back a little bit on that stick. You don't have to move it. You just pull on it, and the airplane will respond.
So it's those type of things that you're talking about, like that little minute. If that was mental, move the plane right, or you could think the movement of the plane, that would just give us another advantage because, you know, that's not two signals. It's not my mind and my hand to pull. That's just my mind saying move.
Yes. So and Air Force Research Labs has been experimenting with connections straight to the brain because it's helping people that are disabled that no longer have those connections through their body to move their arms. If we can figure out the cells in the brain which emanate those kind of signals when our mind thinks about it, we can train the brain too. And someday that will be a reality. We're getting closer every day.
I've enjoyed the interview. I hope you have.
Absolutely. It's always fun to talk about it. It's always fun to have a listening ear because technologists are not understood very well, and I don't think they are appreciated because every technology that we invent is intended for the good, but it ends up in evil hands. So yes, we have the internet. That was a Navy invention, the internet. I mean, that was to send lots of data for large projects to send information across the country. That's a huge project. But then on the other hand, it's used in a very negative way. It's used very evil. So no matter what technology is ever developed, evil will always be able to use it in a way that was never intended.
Right. So the main motive was never to do maybe half the things it's being used for.
Now, the exception to that is the military. Every rocket to space was not developed to explore space. It was to put a bomb in somebody's backyard.
Right.
And then once we had developed these rockets, somebody said, well, look, we can send things in space and do some fun things. So some things are invented for
defense.
For the defense and the protection of our nation, or in some nations it was to be aggressive against other nations.
I'm sorry, guys.
I'm just doing military stuff, and I don't think it applies very much. You've gone over a little bit of your current involvement, the type of stuff that you've done, you do here, and your R&D and stuff like that. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add on your involvement, like you do for the university? I'm interested in more along the lines of what you do R&D wise, and what you do for the radio station, because we could probably look up what you teach just by attending one of your classes. That's what everybody does know. How about the radio station and what you do with R&D.
What I like about the radio station is it's student run. This is one of the few radio stations in the country that the station is run by students. I am only there to keep the station legal as far as the signal that comes out, not by the words. I mean, the students have the freedom. Then we have another manager who makes sure that it's legal that way. But what is neat is we're empowering the students here in our senior projects and in the radio station and in other projects we have within this department and in the College of Applied Science and Technology and the engineering technology programs. We want to, if we can empower them to not be limited in what they can do. And so we create little situations to begin with. We're very structured when we start our courses. Then we get to the very unstructured, our capstone course, which is senior project. We require students to be involved in a significant engineering project that requires 300 hours of their time. And we're having design reviews. We've had design reviews all day. We've had 11 teams. We've had 35 students that are making their presentation, put their life on the line. This is the capstone course. We give them a problem. They solve it. I mean, it's all their work. And all we do is we set the parameters. We want to ensure that they're successful. Not all of them are, but we push them as hard as we can, just short of the breaking point. Some have broke. I mean, then we kind of reel backwards as much as we can, because our only hope is to push them as hard as we can and then have a success, and then they can pound their chest and say, look, I did this, and I can do this in the future, and I can solve problems. That's our goal here, is to create very assertive and almost aggressive problem solvers, creative problem solvers. So creativity is very, very important in this department, to be able to solve the problems that are presented to us every single day. We have challenges before us that engineers are expected to fix. And we rise to that challenge and love it and say, thank you for giving us that opportunity. It's like an artist. Mm-hmm. We're doing the same thing, but our tools are different.
I do 3D, I do art, and I do not computer engineering, but computer.
So we have a lot in common with everything else on this campus. Yeah. We wanted to develop our students to be creative problem solvers. And not only creative problem solvers, they have to be assertive and aggressive. And if they're not, they're not going to make a difference in this world. Mm-hmm.
Do you take any students, now that you have students that run the radio station, but do you have engineering students that also work there? Or is it more of a radio station run, but you kind of see what I'm saying, more of the talent is student ran?
On the radio station staff, we have one student engineer that does 90% of the work of the maintenance, the installation, the upgrades, and all I have to do is point them in the right direction, keep up with the technology. And we just finished a senior project for the radio station, which uses the latest internet technology to where on that computer right next to you, I can display everything that's going on that I need to know on the transmitter. So if it malfunctions, or has any difficulty, I don't have to run up there each time. I can do some of the diagnostics from my office here to have a better idea what the problem might be before I even have to go up there. So technology, the students are very involved, even at the radio station level, on instrumentation and control of remote radio stations.
Very cool. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add that maybe historically wise, maybe some of the past professors?
What we've done, electronics technology programs are kind of dying around the country because a lot of that's going overseas. We still have a very strong program because we have changed the focus of our program to night. To give you an example, I think we're the only program in this, and only department in the state of Utah that requires every one of our faculty to teach half their teaching load. I don't know of anybody else that will do that, because we understand that the better students are students that are working full-time and have families that are a little more mature, and they're realizing in life what they want to do, and they want to come back to school. But they can't come back during the day because they have to put a roof over their head and food on their table. So we have half of our students are night students, and we have a full night program. You can complete this whole program at night. And we even encourage that because we encourage families to stay together and we encourage students to work. I think another reason for our success is we encourage students to work in related work while they're going to school. We don't want a student just to be here a full-time student, because then they don't get to develop their related work skills. And we're finding that if you graduate a student without related work, he's going to be unemployed. But if he has the related work and is already a technician or a junior engineer by the time he gets his degree, it just accelerates that process. So we are asking, I'm even asked students to not graduate if they don't have work, saying if you're going to graduate and if you can't get a job right away, you're going to be unemployed for 6 months, and then who's going to hire you? Because the longer you're unemployed, the more suspicious the employer is going to be. So I say hold off on your degree. Go after a minor. You're really close. Start working on your related work, get that built up, and then it just, the two leapfrog between related work and your degree. If they can leapfrog back and forth, it may take a few extra years, but at least you're not going to be unemployed and you'll be able to make the transition into engineering a lot easier than others. So we really encourage related work. So that's another thing that's really quite different about our program.
I don't have any more questions. If you okay. If you had anything else to add,
been my pleasure.
Oh, it's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.